He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He is a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us this evening. It's a wonderful evening, in particular in Cape Town. It's a beautiful weather. We've had a bit of cold, but it's beautiful weather, and I trust Johannesburg likewise. You're with Michael Bagrum this evening, and like we do every week between 6 and 7 on a Tuesday evening, we have a wonderful guest. But before I introduce you to the guest, I normally look at a book that I've been reading and trying to understand things and trying to understand life. Also, remember, you can contact High FM anytime to give advice, to tell me that you want a different guest, you want someone who can talk about a particular topic, or you can complain about what topics we've had in the past. But please, I'd like to hear from you. We've had some interesting input. And this evening we have a wonderful guest as well. But before we go into it, and I normally look at novels, but this week I picked up a book that I had in my bookshelf, and it's the Jutas series of pocketbooks. It's actually really wonderful, despite the fact that you can get every single piece of information you need on the internet. You can go onto websites and you get information. This one's about, as per normal, about the labor law, and it's understanding the Labor Relations Act. Now, I've got books for every single piece of labor legislation. There are 11 pieces of labor legislation, and Jutas have done a sterling work in putting these pocket companions together. So this one's called Understanding the Labor Relations Act. And there was something a bit peculiar about one of the clauses in the Act. I won't go into it, a bit technical. And I looked at their understanding of that particular clause, and it actually made sense. I've then gone back to, obviously, use ChatGPT, and I've gone back to an advocate that I normally brief for trials. And funny enough, the Jutas interpretation is probably the best one. We're going to have a fight about it, but it's actually worthwhile picking up these pocketbooks. It's written in a simple form. It's written for the general public, not for lawyers. And it's worthwhile. If you are an employer, if you're an employee, it's really worthwhile having a look at this, because it takes the legislation and simplifies it, which is a wonderful. And these books cost next to nothing. It's really worthwhile. And it literally is a pocketbook. You can keep it in your back pocket of your trousers. So probably worth getting if you ever have to look at something, at any of the labor legislation. And it's probably a worthwhile exercise to keep it in your bookshelf, especially if you are an employer. It gets a bit expensive to run to your attorney all the time. So what I'm recommending is getting hold of those books, and let's see if you can get some sense out of them. Okay, on to our guest. And we've got a wonderful guest, and I'm very pleased, an old friend of mine. I'm very pleased he's agreed to be with us tonight. A long-serving attorney, both in Johannesburg and Cape Town, is Hilton Geshen. Hilton, a little bit older than me, I think 2 years. Hilton has been practicing law since he did his articles in 1973. So he's been practicing law ever since then. I believe he's still registered, although he's now on his own. And following other forms of income. But Hilton, basically, if you look at his history, he comes from Johannesburg, from the Johannesburg area. He went to King David High School in Linksfield. He did clerkship in Johannesburg as well with Gutenberg, Rosen, and Zeman. Don't think they exist anymore. He did his BProc and then the Attorney's Admission Board exams. He was admitted in 1979, I actually only met him, I think it was about 1980 that I met Hilton at the time, but he was admitted to practice as an attorney of the Court of Appeal, the High Court, the Judicial Commissioner's Court, and the Subordinate Courts of Lesotho. I find that quite interesting. Hilton, you'll tell us whether he ever appeared there. In Cape Town, when I met him, he was working at Malinick, Rest, Richmond, and Closenberg. that he did his professional work then in the early days, 1979 to 81. He then became a partner in 1981, which was quick work, quicker than I ever rose. But he then eventually became a senior partner there, and he specialized in litigation, insolvency, banking, finance, lending, commercial and corporate law. It was in 2003 to 2006 that he joined the Black Economic Empowerment Corporation, Pan-African Group of Companies, and he focused on the closing of transactions primarily in the mining industry, which is interesting because at that stage he was in Cape Town. And then in 2006 to date, he went into his own commercial deal-making firm, basically a lot with the mining transactions. He'll tell us a bit about that, and was involved in the takeover of Wooltrue and the managing its legal and corporate affairs, its JSE listing, and ultimately the reverse takeover of the company by the PBT Group. He was a co-founder of the Tomahawk Group and all the subsidiary companies involved in that, and also was a co-founder of African Pipes, Valves, and Fittings. I've dealt with him quite a lot, and I'm not going to go through all the other experiences he had, but he was the chairman of the Wildlife Society of South Africa, a commissioner in the Small Claims Court, that was donating of his time, which is interesting. He was the chairman of the Sarah Block Orphanage Creche here in Cape Town, 1994 to 2000. He was on the Ranger Children's Home body, governing body, a member of the Board of Governors of United Herzliya Schools. He was, in fact, the honorary lawyer for United Herzliya Schools. Interesting, I picked this up, I didn't know that about you, Hilton, the honorary consul for the United States of Mexico from 2009 to 2015. I would have come to ask for some Mexican food if I'd known about that. But he's been, to a large degree, involved in all areas of law. What I'm hoping to hear from him tonight is a little bit about this background, fill us in a little bit about the CV so we can meet the man, know who you are, Hilton. But Hilton Gishon has done some amazing work at part of his legal career, and I want to hear from one or two of his cases, one of his court cases, one or two of them. Some of the interesting stuff, because I've been fascinated, and as an old friend of mine, I've learned a lot about these stories from him. So I'm looking forward to hearing from you, Hilton, and thank you very much once again for agreeing to come on air with Chai FM 101.9. Thank you, Hilton. Tell us a little bit about the man, about Hilton himself.
Well, thank you, Michael. Firstly, I must start off by saying right up front that you've scraped the barrel by inviting me onto your show. I stopped full-time practice in 2003, so all my experiences are very dated, and there's nothing much current that I can speak about. But
No problem at all. I know there's some very interesting ones, and I'm sure our audience would love to hear.
Right. Well, firstly, I just need to correct you. I studied in Johannesburg, but I'm not from Johannesburg. I was born in Benoni, and at a very young age, after my father died, we moved to Nigel. And I grew up in Nigel, and when I was 13, was sent off to boarding school to King David, Lingsfield. My mother was concerned that I needed a bit of a Jewish upbringing. In Nigel, my nickname was Yuiki, and when I got to King David, my nickname there changed to Chattis. So
just to I love that.
some indication of how I was heading, living in Nigel. But I was very fortunate to serve my articles, if we're talking primarily law, with a firm called Guttenberg, Rosen & Zeman. I was very close to my principal, Joe Rosen. I'm not sure if any of your listeners in Johannesburg recall or knew of Joe Rosen, but he was probably one of the most formidable lawyers that I've ever come across in my life. I studied my entire degree part-time, which meant that I studied concurrently while working as an article clerk, and that's why I had what turned out to be a significant advantage was that I had 5 years of clerkship as opposed to the average two years that most lawyers underwent, they were given dispensation for having a university degree up front. But that enabled me to learn the craft of practicing law a lot more solidly than I think a lot of the lawyers who went off to university and then came to do their articles. I had a concentrated period of mentorship. In addition to which, when I decided to move from Johannesburg, I actually went backpacking around America for a while, met a girl at Tulane University, and just wanted to get back to New Orleans. But my visa had expired and my ticket was also expiring, my return ticket. So I went back to Johannesburg. I rejoined Joe Rosen for a short while, came down to run the Two Oceans Marathon in 1979, and decided that the easiest way to get back to America would be to do a sailing course, which I could only do in Cape Town. So I thought, well, while I'm in Cape Town, I'll spend an extra day or so here and see if I couldn't get a job. Went looking for a job and wandered into the offices of Mellanix after late afternoon. All the partners were there having a drink and told me to sit down and had a discussion. And fortunately, the senior partner then was, the firm was Gerald Mellanix, who had been a partner at Worksman's in Joburg. He knew Joe Rosen and hired me on the spot. He thought that I would have learned something from Joe, and the fact that he had asked me to rejoin him when I got back from America was good enough recommendation for him. So that's actually how I ended up in Cape Town. I didn't intend to be here permanently, but I turned out not to be a very good sailor, but that's a long story, which I'm not going to bore everyone with. And I got going with my career. The firm Mellanix, as it became known as, was primarily a public interest practice. We were doing a lot of work representing the World Council of Churches at the time. We were also representing most of the political prisoners, particularly those that had been prosecuted after the Soweto 1976 riots and that had been banished or sent to Cape Town. They were located or spread over three prisons, primarily. The one was Robben Island. The other was Victor Verster in Paarl, and then one more local in Cape Town called Paulsmoor Prison. So for the first few years, my practice was primarily around representing a lot of the political prisoners who would defy prison orders for the purposes of being prosecuted. And once they were prosecuted, they were entitled to defense lawyers. And our firm was the primary firm defending those prisoners. And so, as I say, I would spend 3 days a week effectively. It was a Monday, a Wednesday, and a Friday. Mondays was Paulsmoor, Wednesdays was generally Robben Island, and Fridays would be Victor Verster out in Paarl. And I, together with a few of the other professional assistants at the time, one of which was Lee Bozulik. You may have remembered Lee Bozulik. He went on to become a judge here in...
Yes, still is. Can I put you on hold for 1 minute?
Yeah, sure.
We're going to have an ad break and remain on air, and we'll come back in a minute's time.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you. You're with Michael Bagram. We're here every Tuesday evening between 6 and 7, every Tuesday between 6 and 7. We always have a wonderful guest, and I've introduced our guest for this evening, Hilton Gishon, who in fact landed up practicing in Cape Town, and I think is still registered with the Law Society. But Hilton's been taking us through some of his CV and introducing us to the man Hilton Gishon, someone who I've known for many, many years, basically from 1980, I think was the first time I met him. And the reality is that Hilton's got some amazing stories to tell us. He's just telling us now about some of the political prisoners at the time after the riots in Soweto, 1976 riots, lot of people were arrested and banished off to Robben Island and to two other prisons in Cape Town. And Hilton actually was with a firm, Mellenix at the time, which were basically the firm, the legal firm of choice to represent many of the political prisoners. I remember that. I also remember a story where one of the secretaries from Mellenix eventually married one of the political prisoners. Maybe he'll tell us a bit about that, but he's got some amazing stories to tell us. So, Hilton, just to catch up with you again, you were telling us about the 3 days a week that you spent with these political prisoners and applying to court, obviously, or for various things. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, as I was saying, the cases that we ran were primarily in the prisons, in the prison for the prisoners who were being sanctioned or censured for disobeying prison orders. They were entitled to legal representation, and that actually gave them a window to the outside world. There were so many of them that, in fact, they're too many to mention, and my memories become a little distant. But there were two prisoners in particular that I do recall, and you mentioned a secretary from our firm. The one prisoner was Tokyo Sexwale, who went on to become the premier of Gauteng. And Tokyo was quite a robust guy. I'm not sure if people knew it, but he was called Tokyo because he was always interested in karate and Japanese martial arts. And that's how he got his nickname. But the burden of representing the political prisoners was becoming more and more difficult. And it was becoming so heavy that we couldn't meet with the prisoners in the morning and represent them 2-3 hours later, minute statements from them and proceed. So we started to bring some of our professional assistants in and some secretaries even who could write quicker than we could to minute statements from them and then carry on with sort of half an hour later after reading the statements to represent them. And one of the people that we brought in was a lady by the name of Judy Moon. And she started minuting the statements, and it was they started to volunteer to actually do it, and I got a bit concerned. Judy started spending a lot of time at coming with us to Robben Island, we didn't know that there was a relationship blossoming between her and Tokyo, and subsequent off to the release of the unbanning of the ANC and the release of political prisoners. Judy carried on a relationship with Tokyo and subsequently married him. One of the other political prisoners that I developed a long-term relationship with was a man by the name of Toiva Yotoiva. Toiva was actually the founder of SWAPO and the leader of SWAPO for many years until he was arrested and banished from Namibia. In those days, it was still Southwest Africa, and imprisoned on Robben Island. And I represented him on many occasions, and we really developed a good relationship. And one day he just disappeared from the scene. He wasn't there. I thought that maybe he had stopped disobeying prison orders and he had resigned himself to his fate and no longer wanted to see me or any of the other attorneys that would visit Robben Island to represent them. And I lost touch with him. And funny enough, in about 1978, 79.
And can I just stop you there? Were you going to Robben Island as the attorney representing them? I suppose you could bring them some reading material or chocolate or some outside touch, because I remember reading the books by President Mandela about his time at Robben Island and how cut off they felt, that they didn't see people. I think the family visits were sparse. People couldn't get to them. First of all, it was expensive for families to get to Cape Town. And second of all, they weren't allowed to come in. And then whatever they brought in was censured and taken away from them. So isn't it? add to their life, at least make it a little bit more pleasant on the island.
Yeah, exactly. That was primarily a big reason for them disobeying prison orders, so that they could have contact with the outside world. Not all the attorneys that represented them and attended would look to assist them to that extent. But I and my colleagues from Mellonix, we always would take chocolates and biscuits and stuff like that into the consultation rooms. And when we'd sit with them, we would pass it over to them. We would open up files, and we occasionally were able to get letters from their family that we would pass on to them. One of the other issues that we knew what was happening is, while there weren't cameras in the room, we knew that the authorities were listening in, but they couldn't admit to the fact that they were, because they were in breach of your attorney-client confidentiality. So it was always a game that we played with them, where we knew that they were listening, but there was nothing much that they could do about it. And we used to torment them with things like that. So yes, you're correct. We did. We also used to pass over our newspapers that we would bring onto the island. But after a while, actually, the authorities got wise to that, and they started confiscating our newspapers before we went into the consulting room with the prisoners. So, but it was always a wonderful occasion to meet with them. A lot of them were sort of resigned to their lot and were open about it. And we just could often just talk about many things, and as I say, be their window to the world. But I want to get back to Toivo, because Toivo was a special man. He was a big, tall chap. He very stately, and when you were in his presence, you actually could sense that he had a very powerful personality. And as I was saying, so in about 1978, 79, I was doing work for a man who was doing marine mining activities off the coast of Oranjemund, and he used to berth his vessels in Walvis, and they would be repaired there. And he was looking to list his company on the Namibian Stock Exchange, as it was then. And so I and his accountant, together with Norman Lowenthal — I'm sure the listeners will remember Norman, who was a well-known stockbroker in Johannesburg, he was also chairman of the JSE at the time — he was going to assist with the listing of the company. We all went off to Namibia, and the client was meant to join us, but he ended up being delayed on a business trip in Australia. So we had to conduct the meeting on his behalf, and I made a speech on behalf of the client. And at the speech were ministers and deputies and some very esteemed guests and captains of the Namibian economy. And when I was speaking, I was on a podium, and I couldn't really see the audience because there were lights shining in my eyes. And afterwards, I stepped off it, and I heard this voice, "Hilton," and I was embraced by this force of nature, and it was Toivo, who I hadn't seen for a few years, and it was just wonderful. And he made a big fuss of me, and he took his cufflinks off, and he publicly gave me his cufflinks as a token of his appreciation, and he introduced me to the various ministers that were there. And we continued our friendship, and he invited me, insisted that I came after the presentation, that I come home with him. And he introduced me to his wife, and it was fascinating to see that he had married a woman from New York, a Jewish lady who was a very left-leaning liberal, who was a labor lawyer in New York. And she had met Toivo, fallen in love with him, and immigrated to Namibia and got married to him. And they had, at that stage, it was two infants, it was twins, twin girls. And eventually the girls came to UCT, and I used to see them from time to time when they were here, and I would help them if they needed any outside assistance. So
it's amazing, just to break in there, Toivo was probably one of the Namibian greats. He rose to the very top. He was an enormous influence on the politics of Namibia. It's wonderful to hear that you were able to help the man while he was in prison in South Africa. It's actually a wonderful story to my mind, in that some of our own people from our tiny little Jewish community, both in Cape Town and Johannesburg, were able to do such wonderful things. What you did must have been heroic, because at the end of the day, there were very few people that wanted to come forward and help. I think you look back on that fondly, and I think you should actually give yourself a round of applause, because it is amazing.
Yeah, look,
what do you think?
It was something that I wanted to do, and something that we did. But it became short lived, because the firm actually needed to branch out and start doing some proper commercial practice. Otherwise, we were going insolvent slowly. So we pivoted slightly, and because of my experience and the fact that I'd spent 5 years doing my articles and I'd had a lot of court experience, we started to compartmentalize the firm and departmentalize it, and I ended up being stuck into as head of litigation in the late 70s, early 80s, and started building up a litigation practice, concentrating primarily on commercial disputes. And then it morphed into banking law. I'm not quite sure how it happened, but the South African Reserve Bank one day called me, the head of the Deposit Taking Institutions Department, which was a subsidiary of the Reserve Bank, said that he had got to hear of me and he'd like to come and meet me. His name, funny enough, was Christo Visser, but a very different Christo Visser, and to the one that is a well-known entrepreneur here in Cape Town. And I met with him, and he asked me if I would be happy to do work for the Reserve Bank, and I said yes, I would. And we discussed my rates, which were a lot more than what we were being paid by the World Council of Churches, and so it became a very significant client to the firms. So I did a lot of banking law. I started to do a lot of work in regard to the Deposit Taking Institutions Act, as it then was, and dealing with a lot of the renegade financiers and banks that were in breach of the various legislations that governed them. And I got involved and put a number of significant financial institutions either under curatorship or into liquidation, starting with Masterbond was one of them. Others was Cape Investment Bank, which at the time was owned by the Pickard family. And that became a proper Boeretwist fight between the South African Reserve Bank, the time the Rail Commuters Corporation, which had also put a lot of money into CRB as it was known, and everyone started to turn on the Pickard family. They were a very well-known family. Bull Pickard was a former Springbok captain. The bank was effectively started by his son. And that in itself was quite a mammoth task. Some of the other institutions I dealt with was Funds Trust, which caused Gilby's to go out of business and exit the country. Gilby's Gin, it had a major subsidiary here in South Africa, and it was defrauded quite extensively by an institution that was started by Jan S. Marais, who was the founder of Trust Bank. So we had a large series of inquiries followed by litigation. And in fact, Jan Marais ended up with a suspended sentence as a result of the role that he played in Funds Trust. And then there was also Owen Wiggins Trust and...
all well-known disputes. I remember all of those so far. I mean, us through some of them.
Yeah, listen, it's a long time ago. I mean, I'm talking about the 70s and the 80s. But you know,
well, in the inside story is always fascinating.
Well, the interesting thing with Cape Investment Bank was that it was a bank that it was the first time I think that a bank actually was put into liquidation in the end. A liquidator was appointed, a forensic team of investigators were appointed to look into various of the transactions and in particular the investments that the bank had made, whether or not the bank had fulfilled its governance requirements, whether it had its documentation in respect of the loans that it had advanced were competent. And there were so many governance issues that were lacking that it ended up being a five-year stint winding up the bank. And it became quite, being the first properly failed bank as it was at the time, the Reserve Bank was very reluctant to guarantee all the deposits and pay everybody out. But in the end, we actually recovered about 98% of the capital that had been lost. And the bank topped up a couple of the investors with the 2%. So it turned out to be quite a significant success for the Reserve Bank. There's so much that went on, Michael, I wouldn't know where to begin, quite frankly. We, in our recovery process, we only lost one case. It was against a man in Johannesburg. I'm not sure if any of the listeners know him. It's a long time ago. It was a Mr. Nimrod Van Sale, who had been lent a lot of money.
And I remember that as well. Can I hold you in 1 second? If you could log out of the platform completely for 1 minute and then come back, log on exactly the same link that I've given you earlier on. You're going to have an ad break again.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us once again. We always support our advertisers, so thank you for that. It's always good to have the commercial break. You're with Michael Bagram every Tuesday between 6 and 8, every Tuesday evening between 6 and 8 p.m. Well, the bottom line is that we have a wonderful guest here this evening. It's attorney Hilton Gishon. Hilton's taken us through his whole background. And he's now reached the point where he's telling us about some of the commercial disputes that he had, the liquidation of the Cape Investment Bank, which I'm sure we all remember that. It was quite an event, especially in Cape Town. I think it was the first bank in South Africa that went mahula. And it's interesting to hear about the attorney who represented the Reserve Bank at the time, and Hilton Gishon was taking us through that. Hilton?
Yeah, Michael, just as an aside, it's not really legal or law related. Just before the bank, we'd put the bank under curatorship at first. And right. The Reserve Bank was looking to try and find a partner to merge the bank with someone who had more banking experience. And they came across a guy from Johannesburg by the name of Johan Bellingham. Johan Bellingham had his own little bank, and he had been contacted by the Reserve Bank, and they had suggested that the two banks merge and they would facilitate it. And I was sent to Johannesburg to meet Johan Bellingham together with the interim curator at that stage, with a view to seeing how to merge the banks and put them together and just go through the feasibility of it together with the couple of accountants from KPMG, the Johannesburg office. He was a well-known forensic investigator there at the time by the name of John Lowe. And we were the team that was going to put this merger together. And we were busy in this meeting. We'd been meeting I'd flown up to Joburg on the Tuesday night, met with Johan on the Wednesday, the Thursday, and continued on the Friday. We were putting together a framework, and eventually Johan had said to us that he needed to leave. He was heading off to on a hunting trip to Zimbabwe, and he had to leave by midday on the Friday. And I still said to him, being a conservationist at heart, I said to him, what are you going hunting? And he said, no, he was going hunting buffalo. And I said, well, I hope you're going to use a crossbow or a bow and arrow so that you can even the odds a little bit. It's not really much of a sport when you sit with a telescopic sight and a high-powered rifle and shoot the animal 200-300 meters away, if not further. So he started telling me how dangerous it was, and I didn't take much notice of it. But I flew back to Cape Town, and I remember so clearly opening the Sunday Times on the Sunday morning, and the front page news was about a hunter who had been killed by a wounded buffalo on the Saturday, and it was Johan Bellingham. What had happened was he had shot the buffalo, and he hadn't killed it. He had wounded it, and the buffalo went in a massive big semicircle and attacked him. He was with a guide, and his wife and son were behind him. And the buffalo came out of the bushes and charged them and actually hit Johan from the back. And as it hit Johan, the gun went off, and Johan shot and killed the tracker, the guide in front of him. And Johan's wife and child scrambled up a mapani tree, and that's what saved them. But the buffalo killed Johan, and that actually, it was just... it's a thought that, it's a memory that came to mind while I was telling the story. But that was the reason why the merger actually didn't take place, and we eventually decided to put the bank into liquidation.
It's interesting because a lot of people say attorneys charge like wounded buffaloes. I don't know if you've ever heard the concept.
Yeah, I don't think I was accused of that.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted you. So you were in, what actually happened with the CIB? You say they actually got most of their money back, that they were able to claw it back and then pay the depositors.
Yeah, we paid back 98% of the money that had been invested in the bank, both by the Reserve Bank, the Royal Commuters Corporation, and a couple of other funds, fund managers who had invested in the bank. So it was quite a feat. We ran a massive 417 inquiry to investigate all the transactions, to investigate those listeners who don't know, Section 417 of the Companies Act was under the old Companies Act, which still has application in the current act, was a mechanism to investigate the affairs of a company to see who owed it money and how it could recover monies that might be owing to it, and so on and so forth. So we ran a massive inquiry that went on for almost a year, and concurrently with that inquiry, we were instituting various actions against companies that were indebted to the bank to recover. That was very difficult. Many of the agreements actually envisaged what and prescribed what should happen when the borrower went bankrupt, not when the lender went bankrupt. So it was just a very interesting exercise in working through it. But as I say, we were, I think, by all accounts, very successful in our endeavors. And we had some very satisfied people after the process. But, you know...
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, just thinking about my actual career and some of the interesting matters that I dealt with. The most interesting, actually, as far as I'm concerned, and the ones that have stuck in my memory more than anything else, are the ones that were not related to what I was specializing in. There were two cases in particular that I dealt with outside of my speciality. The one was I acted for a really clever man by the name of Professor Dennis Cowan. Any of the listeners who are of our vintage who would have
studied law,
studied law would have come across a textbook by Professor Dennis Cowan called The Law of Negotiable Instruments. It was a red book, and it dealt with every aspect of financial paper, from checks to promissory notes to acknowledgements of debt, any liquid document that could be prepared that would enable a method of financing a third party. And Professor Cowan worked at the time, I think, for the Johannesburg City Council, but he had a house in Cape Town. He had been a lecturer at UCT. And he did a stint. I'm not sure the reason. He once told me that he was sort of seconded to the Joburg City Council to help them out on a particular issue, and that's how he found himself in Johannesburg. But he then moved back to Cape Town. He got hold of me and he told me his tale of woe. He had a holiday house in the beachside village called Roy Els, and he had been elected onto the Roy Els local council, and he was very upset by the fact that on the weekends that he was there, missiles and explosions were being launched from a missile testing site on the other side of the mountain, just behind Roy Els. And he was very perturbed by the bangs and the noises that were coming from the testing site. He made some inquiries and he found that Somchem, which was a subsidiary of Arms Corps, was leasing from the Overberg Regional Services Council, which was the sort of provincial body in the area, a piece of land, and they were paying 500 rands per year for the privilege of using the area, which was a catchment area for the testing of armaments and weapons. And he was concerned that the residue from the weapons was polluting the water that was in the catchment area and that flowed into the rivers and that came down the mountains and filled the tanks of the residents of Roy Els. So he got together with the other...
Also one of the world's most pristine agricultural land was there as well, plus, of course, beautiful sea line. The sea Fynbos. Over there, completely untouched, beautiful. Fynbos Sea, it was a beautiful, and it still is to this day, enormously expensive property there. Yeah, yes, so, carry on. Sorry, I interrupted.
So Dennis got hold of me and he said to me, right, this is what we're going to do. Are you man enough to do it? And are you able to do it? And I stupidly said yes, not knowing just how difficult he was. But that was another story. We assembled a great team. We got hold of a King's Counsel who was in Cape Town. He was a legal legend by the name of Long David, David de Villiers. He had been the CEO of NASPAS before.
Early days, yes.
But it wasn't called NASPAS. I think it was De Burger, the company that owned De Burger, and it subsequently then, I think it was renamed NASPAS. But he was a real legal luminary and an absolute intellect, and I got him involved, and I got Michael Donan, who today is, I think I've lost touch with Michael, but he might be a senior counsel in Cape Town today. I'm not.
He's in fact my neighbour.
Oh, okay. So,
living up in Islands Estate.
Okay, well, remind Michael Donan about the trauma he suffered at the hands of
professor. I will. Can I just stop you for 1 minute for an ad break again? We must pay the bills, but stay online.
Want to get behind-the-scenes photos? See what happens in studio? Miss the documentary?
History will not give the Jewish people another chance.
Benjamin Netanyahu at war.
Follow High FM on Facebook and Twitter, where we post the links just for you. High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Thank you. We're back on air, and I'm here with a wonderful guest, Attorney Hilton Geschen, living in Cape Town, and has taken us through some of his early days in law firm Malinex, and he's now talking about an interesting case that he did, which was outside his area of expertise. If you can carry on, Hilton.
Yeah, so we brought an application to court to review and set aside the decision of the Overberg Regional Council to let the land to Somchem. And we were given a proper runaround, firstly, to get the record of the decision that was taken to enter into the lease. It had been... entered into many, many years before, and this missile testing zone had been and an armament testing site had been used for years and years. Eventually, we got it. We had to bring a whole lot of interlocutory inquiries, but eventually, we had the record. Then we reworked our papers and we amended the relief that we were seeking for the purposes of setting aside the lease on the grounds that it was illegal, it was irrational. They hadn't taken into account the effects that the residue from the armaments would have on the environment. And before the judgment could be granted, Somchem decided to pack their bags and they moved on to go and carry out their testing further up the coast.
Can we stop now for another 1 minute ad? Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Ah, okay. Sorry about that. I'm not sure why the ad came on. Sorry, I stopped you. So they went to another area. In fact, I know where they went to. They went to where the whale trail is held today. Then again, it was pristine coastline, in fact, full of whales and sharks and dolphins. And they went there, and I remember on the whale trail, and I went many times on the whale trail, we stayed in a beautiful house belonging to one of our ex-presidents in South Africa. But it was a horrific exercise doing missiles out there. But sorry, Hilton, I interrupted you.
No, you're 100% right. It was out in Honiston and that they moved to, and I still remember Dennis Cowan chuckling at the thought that P.W. Buerto, with the time was still the president, would have the missiles flying over his head while he was relaxing out in the region. So,
yeah, correct.
Anyway, you know, one of the other cases that really stick in my head was a medical malpractice case that I ran. I had, when I moved to Cape Town, I met a young advocate who was a proper adversary of mine. I had a couple of actions against him appeared in front of the magistrate's court, where he actually appeared against me a few times. And initially we didn't have much of a relationship, but I think we had a begrudging, well, not think, we had a begrudging respect for each other. And one day he just disappeared also from Cape Town. I actually heard that he wasn't someone that I briefed or I had a rapport with, but I'd heard that he had immigrated off to Australia. And he came back to South Africa to visit his family. And he had one daughter at the time who, after her birth, his wife had suffered an injury to her uterus, and she was told she could have she would not be able to have any further children. So he came out to South Africa to visit his family. It was a couple of years after he had immigrated, probably 4 or 5 years, and his wife discovered that she had a real miracle pregnancy, and so he went back to Australia to carry on practicing in Perth, where he had moved to, and his wife and daughter stayed on in South Africa and was looked after by her mother and her in-laws, which was Guy's parents. And one day he phoned me to ask me if he could meet with me. And I was surprised. I didn't know that he'd come back. And he told me the most terrible tale, that his wife had given birth on a Sunday to a little boy at the Constantia Medical Hospital, Constantiaberg Mediclinic it was called, and that for some unknown reason that he couldn't get to the bottom of, her heart went into fibrillation. And he survived, but came out with severe brain damage. He wasn't sure at the time whether she was going to live, and he asked me whether I could assist him in trying to get to the bottom.
I'm going to cut the story short because we've run out of time, but if you could just end it off quickly. You did take it to court. I remember the case.
You won the case.
Am I correct?
Correct. It went on for many, many years, and we actually ended up settling it. We got J. judgment on the merits, and we settled the quantum. And it was one of the highest awards ever paid by a medical insurance company in the history of South Africa. So it was a resounding success in the end. But it was as a result of the hospital trying to cover up the fact that the defibrillator machine that they had wasn't working. That was the bottom line. So honesty is always the best policy in life.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I'm cutting you short. Hilton Gishon, the most wonderful person, a great friend of mine. I must tell you, Hilton, thank you ever so much for giving of your time to talk to us this evening. We really appreciate it. And thank you. Thank you very much.